For the record, we are recording the sessions.
We are? Are we?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Things are happening behind my back.
Okay. You did not say nothing about progress.
Okay. So, yes, please.
Thank you very much, Rania, for that unpacking of economic theory and trying to really bringing it home to the ground, particularly for us planners, because you know, we tend to use you know, aggregate terms without deconstructing. But you have really done so, and you've made me look a little bit funny. I'll give you an example. You know, when we are talking about, you brought the idea of the cash transfer, and we don't talk about, we don't look at processes. We say, oh, poverty. We need cash transfers, and you know, and we put these things in our documents just like that, without really trying to deconstruct, you know. You'll say cash transfers for the poor people, cash transfers for the youth, but are they all facing the same conditions? To me, you know, it's like you are saying that I think we really need to be a little bit more analytical in whatever we are doing and not just importing, you know. And really some of these are things that are coming to us, you know, from all those beautiful institutions that we are associating with. They come with one prescription and we just take them on wholesale. We do not deconstruct. And I am really very, very happy that you are breaking these things and you are encouraging us to be a little bit more analytical in our approach.
First, thanks very much for the presentation, Rania. It was very eye-opening for me. In a sense, I'm glad that I didn't go the traditional route to economics and then come here. I think my transition would be a bit more difficult. So I think for me, it's good that this is my starting point. I had a question about scarcity. I was wondering, one of the things that I grappled with when I was doing earlier reading in economics is why so much on this issue, you know, as a foundation principle, this issue of scarcity, because from coming from the political economy approach or even from the approach of social policy, to me it wasn't so much scarcity but rather a difference, the nature of distribution and the management of resources rather than scarcity. You know, so there was enough for everyone, but it was just how it was distributed or how it was managed. So I was wondering if you could expand that a bit more so I could understand how it is then related to the asymmetries of power that you had gone into.
Well, let me tackle.
Thank you. I think I like the idea of the issue around the power relations, because actually when it comes to women's unpaid work, I think it's the lack of freedom or the lack of choice. Because if it is a typical economic activity, you might say, I will not grow beans this year because there is no high return. But you can never say, I will not feed the children because, you know, there is no return. So those are the issues that women are in. There is no trade-off. This is something you have to do, and that's it. whether the your government is provisioning the kind of services that would allow you to do it better or to alleviate your unpaid work. The other issue is that the status of women in a particular culture is what determines whatever comes next. If you are in a culture where girls are not wanted from when they are born, you know, it determines the kind of value that is put on their work, the kind of ability they have to access social capabilities, be it education, or some economic opportunities later, or the political power and voice. So if as a woman you are nothing in a particular society, you cannot, your needs cannot be addressed adequately by the economic frameworks. Thank you.
Start with commenting a little bit on this first three issues. First of all, thank you very much for your kind comments, Sylvia. I'm glad that in some ways it resonates in terms of your own work and issues that you face. I want to address a little bit the issue of scarcity, because we have these very two different approaches in general in economics. One I would call the classical approach, the other very much the neoclassical approach. One that is based on examining how production takes place, under what conditions, what technologies, who does what, etc. How do you distribute that output, both in terms of who gets how much, but also in terms of how much you invest in the future, how much you consume right now, etc., etc., so that you allow the existence and reproduction of a system. Because if you produce it all and you eat it all, then next year you don't have seeds. So there was a preoccupation, actually, with ability to exist, ability to reproduce the conditions of existence of people, and how this came to face constraints, difficulties, and breakdowns. So that was a preoccupation, actually, and there's a lot that we can learn if one goes back, in terms of economics, into the theory and approach of classical economics. Who disagreed among themselves? Let me tell you, that this idea about obsession, essentially the scarcity, comes in the 1870s with two Econ Jevons, Wildgrass, and Menger, and all of them somehow within the same type of period start, you know, thinking about utility, disutility, how prices get determined through very different processes than what classical economists. So there is a before and after in my mind, in my own mind. And then you get, of course, you get the revolutionary thinking of Keynesian economics. But there is an intersection today between a version, I would call it, of Marxian analysis that looks at the limitations of why systems cannot be reproduced and what is happening at the global scale, that puts a lot of emphasis on institutions, and integrates feminist analysis. And this is my favorite term. And I hope that out of this project, I have to be very clear. As I said, we have to be open about where we come from. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to accumulation processes and growth and profitability, I have a lot of respect for the analysis that comes from the Marxian tradition. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to institutions, well, we would not be in the mess that we are now internationally had there not been two events in terms of the international financial architecture. Mm-hmm. One was that banks were allowed to become investment houses. Mm-hmm. The other was that leveraging was encouraged. And at the time of the dot-com boom, at the time that U.S. was doing excellent in the 90s, you had Greenspan supervising the whole thing and saying, yes, you can have less and less money down for all the hedge funds, etc., so they can be very highly leveraged. And then so we started actually with the Glass-Steagall, which was under President Clinton, that allowed banks to become, okay,
investment places, investment houses. Now, this is an institutional arrangement that brought it about, but we have to always go a step further. And the step further is, why did the institutional change come about? What happened? You see, the institutionalists will give us this context, and we say, all of what is happening today is because of institutions. Then comes Marxian theory. And you can trace it back to Rosa Luxemburg, to Hilferding, to Marx in some ways, that says profitability has its limits. So what was happening globally was an issue of profitability. There was an issue of profitability. Especially the banking sector in the United States, which means what? And in Europe, which means what? You know, the banking system at the time, was experiencing rapid deterioration in profitability. So they were allowed to enter and merge, which means not only downsize and use less labor, which major issue, right? But also remove obstacles so that they can go around and literally plant the world. Make profits out of no productive activity in order to save the financial institutions declining profitability, the financial sector declining profitability. Okay, where does the gender come into this? I will not continue because then I will need another hour to finish it up, but we will be discussing this. So I completely agree, and I not agree with what you said, that it is not an issue of scarcity. It is an issue of allocation of resources. And that is the starting point, and that is also something we have to keep in mind when we look at policy reactions. It came from, what is her name, Blair? The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, head of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation.
Sheila Bair.
Sheila Bair, thank you very much. I always call her Blair for some reason, okay. Sheila Bair, okay, she's a Republican. I have no reason to be in favor of the lady. Just because she's a lady does not mean anything to me. But what she proposed very early on, when, I don't know how many, you are clearly familiar with probably what she said, but I don't know how many of you are aware of her suggestion as to how we could get out of the financial mess. She said, don't save the banks, save the homeowners. If you were to pay down the debt, you will be doing recapitalization through the back door, and you will not need to bail out banks, nationalize banks, give them this incentive, that incentive. People would keep their homes, and we would move much in a much smoother way. But that is redistribution. That is giving poor people that cannot afford to have a home, a home. And saving the banking sector that we all need because we live in a capitalist society is important. Saving the poor folks that have a little house is not. Even if they were duped by the banks into buying them. So redistribution and distribution are things that are so prevalent in theory, in what construction we have of the economy, in the responses, the policy responses. It is really everywhere, so I couldn't agree
more with your comment. And the last issue, the last question that Taco raised was the, if I remember correctly, my scribbling here, is about the importance of culture in delineating what is possible and what is not possible. And I will not disagree with you, but I want to unpack a little bit what we call culture. In some ways, I'm not an anthropologist, I am not really a student of this, these issues, but I will tell you what my personal reflections are. Culture is contestable. There are sets of principles, actually, at any given point in time that regulate behavior, interactions, etc., that are inherited and out of respect and inability to do otherwise. I have colleagues in this room that will tell me, I'm not religious, but I cannot eat meat. I can eat fish. I was raised that way, and I'm not religious. Right? There are things and ways, you know, that we develop. I don't want to go to the contentious issue of gender yet. So the issue, I guess, for me has always been the recognition of two things. One is, what are the types of exclusion? And as you said, no access to education, determining what kinds of jobs you will have in the future, straitjacketing you into having to do secluded work within the four walls of the compound that you live in. All kinds of issues, right? But I also see the kind of exclusion that comes through the cultural acceptance of consumerism. I also see the exclusion that takes place in a system like the one we live in right now, and a poor person cannot keep their home, but you can have a wage disparity between the people that brought down this entire system, the bankers and the managers, with the workers that were doing all the cleaning and all the taking care of, that is humane and acceptable. Isn't that a cultural value? So I'm not contesting the impact of culture. I'm just saying that the principles by which we live, I think, extend beyond religion and beyond the locality of the ethnicity and the clan that I come from. I come from halfway from Turkey, halfway from Greece. So being a mixed child, I inherited all kinds of, I wouldn't call only some very positive things and some things that were extraordinarily constraining to me. But to me, that also is embedded in other kinds of accepted norms that restrict us. I was in Mexico some months back, I don't remember exactly when, I think last November, and I remember a woman, an Indian woman, from Mexico, who was explaining to us what exactly she had to go through in order to be able to vote, but she did not stop in voting. She petitioned to be elected, and she was elected in her community. Mm-hmm. And there were voices of contestation from the ground. And then I was speaking just 4 days ago to the resident representative of UNDP in El Salvador, a wonderful, wonderful human being. And she was telling me that when it comes to unpaid work and all of that, it is so difficult to raise any concern. So here you have somebody who seemingly is powerless, a woman that is from some small area, that is contesting the patriarchal structures, and she's winning. She gets elected. And here you have somebody who comes with a lot of power, actually. Being a res rep in the country, that carries a lot of weight, right? Mm-hmm. And she cannot open her mouth in any meeting to bring in the issue that is valuable to her. Mm-hmm. That was a lesson that I learned, actually, from Amit Baduri, who is going to be visiting us for the conference. I sent him a paper, and I was equating powerlessness with poverty. And he said to me, you have not spent enough time in there. You come to conferences. You have to come out there with me. Yeah. And you have to see women protesting and raising their voices that come from the untouchables of the untouchables, the poorest of the poor. Mm-hmm. And don't make the mistake and equate the poor. And I think that was a very valuable lesson. How am I doing with time?
Perfect. We have 15 more minutes.
15? Oh, wonderful. Thanks. All right. Please. Microphone.
Okay. Thank you for so interesting presentation. And I have a question. During your presentation and during your answers, you touch mainly issues of poverty. Of course, I assume that during poverty, the issues of gender and gender inequality are more sharp. But what about middle class and well-off people? How we incorporate gender in such level? What are the gender issues in this regard? Can you a little bit explain or give some, how to say, general picture of this. Thank you.
Could we be passing the microphone down? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rania. I would like to say, like, about one thing that I think I have a little bit of this lens that you were talking about, and especially I would like to say that when we're talking a lot of gender, and from my point of view, or maybe I'm wrong, but we cannot forget about that we are within an the feminist epistemology. So I think sometimes, and I have here a lot of colleagues from the UN, and in UN and in international meetings, we're a lot missing this point that the gender perspective born within the feminist framework. So sometimes, and being in this feminist framework and being in this feminist epistemology, it means that we have there is a lot of philosophical background, and there is also a political position, and in this framework there have been a lot of women and also some men, not as much as maybe we want, but we have also always to recognize this, and especially with people who is working in the UN, I would say that we have not be ashamed about that. This gender perspective and all of this gender awareness comes from the feminist and the feminism, and we are still creating, and we're going to be doing that in different ways and different positions and different kinds of feminism. And also the feminism is not like a movement that starts by its own. It starts with different other movements like the Marxism and in the Illustration movement maybe in Europe, whatever, no, and that's why the difference, and that's why, like, I like Rania when you also talk a little bit about the Marxism, and well, for me the difference is very clear, because the Marxists and the communists, they think that everything is in the class, you know, what she was talking, but the gender thing crosses all classes and always crosses all ethnicities and, well, and other things. And then another thing that I wanted to say about the scarcity and about the allocation of resources, one thing that I'm thinking since I've been here, I've been in Guatemala, I think that, for example, we're talking about resources, we talk about, I don't know if it makes sense in English, tangible, that things that you can, tangible actives, like financial, credit, whatever. But I think that I'm thinking, and I think that we should start to think about like non-tangible actives, like, for example, the knowledge. And we need to think about other ways of valuing these actives that maybe that the other branches of economy, they don't do it. And then I think that maybe in the feminist we have to start, or maybe, no, a lot of people started, a lot of women, and some men started before, but I think we should start to think about the ways of how value or how to recognize these other knowledges and that they are not tangible. I don't know.
Thank you, Rania, for the presentation. I want to stay always on this philosophical and epistemological thing, to say that, to focus on the interdisciplinarity. While you were presenting, I see a lot of dimension of sociologists and psychological, especially when you talk about the concept of behavior. This make me think that it's not economy in terms of market, as you said, but it's bring people into the picture. And my question is, how can we identify the limitation now? What makes this economy and gender awareness specific, according to the other theory? thank you very much for the insightful presentation. I have a question, and I might actually seem to be playing a little bit of the devil's advocate by this question, but you mentioned something about identifying differences in behavioral patterns. And what came to mind, first of all, was how many classifications or how many different types of behaviors would we be looking at in that sense? Which types of behavior would be more important? I understand that gender is one of them, but which other types would be more important? And how feasible, really, would it be to look at all different types of behavior?
So I want to I would like to start with the last question last question. I will respond as if I am trying to represent what feminist economists and feminist economics advocate. So, first of all, gender is used always as one analytical category, in the sense that, as Eka said, gender by itself is not only poverty. Gender has many different sort of implications for different groups of people. So, class would be a different. Nationality, I am repeating Nancy Fulbright 25 years ago, where she was talking about nationality. It makes a big difference if you're a poor woman in the United States and if you're a poor woman in Haiti and if you're a poor woman in Greece. And even if the classification system of each country would bring you to the, you know, below the poverty line, it is not only about consumption. It is, poverty is multidimensional. The process that brought you to poverty, how can you get out, what are the possibilities, etc., many, many differences. So I completely agree with you that we have to always bring in multidimensionality. Now, when it comes to modeling, feminist economists would say that you do not come up with one answer in terms of behavior that then you apply to all questions. The answer, I think, and I have many friends here that I hope will be checking on my answer, the behavioral difference will depend a lot on what is the question that you're asking. So if the question that I'm asking relates to the degree to which women endure risk in savings, the form in which they save in order to protect family smoothing in consumption in the future, then my answer will be very specific in terms of differences between men and women. In terms of risk, they are a lot less, they are more risk adverse, so that is important to know. We know they will save in jewelry. We know they will save in forms that can be liquidated. We know that because the items men save in are more durable and considered by the household as more important for the survival, whether it is a bicycle, a home that you pay the mortgage on, will not be the first ones to be liquidated. We know that in cases of microenterprises, women will sell the small assets for consumption smoothing. And then they will not be able to recover as fast as other segments of the economy. So really, the behavioral pattern, including the fact, you know, there is this thing that is called the good mother thesis. I think Niloufer came up with it, or somebody came up with it, which said that when you give money to women, or Diane Elson was it? I don't remember. When you give money to women, they will spend it on their children a lot more than men. And this has informed policy in the United Kingdom. No, this is good, eh?
You can all hear me? Yeah. It informed policy in the United Kingdom, where cash transfers were given to the primary caretakers, not to the mother, not to the family, because the one that has the most attachment to the children is the one that will spend more on the children, if this is the plan. And the difference in behavior and in reaction has informed also the questions we have asked at times of crisis in the informal sector: how do men and women behave? So I would say that what we have talked about so far is very abstract, actually. It is at a very high level of abstraction. How this translates now into modeling and into examining concretely all kinds of questions when you look at that behavioral difference, I hope we will have the time. Yes, definitely we will have the time to go into detail. So one thing I don't want anyone to misunderstand is that when I say that there are all these different behavioral patterns, etc., I don't mean to say that it is a big mess out there and therefore we cannot assume uniformity and therefore, you know, you put your hands up and there's nothing you can do about it. No, a lot we can get more concrete. I'll leave the feminism last because I think it belongs to the very conclusion of this first session. The general picture of upper class women. I will go back to Amit, because he said to me, the end of that sentence, that when he said, come to me, when you come to India, don't go to conferences, come to me and we'll travel the country. He ended the sentence by saying that the poor woman demonstrating and screaming and yelling and standing out there for rights has a lot more control over her life than the upper class women. That, and he said, I know many of them in India, that my heart goes out to them a lot more. Because they, whether they have internalized the values or whatever, they will not move, not all, but many, without permission. The husband has to know exactly where she is and what she's doing every single moment of the day. She wants to spend a big chunk of money to do something, although the money is there. A lot of money is there, actually. She has to ask for permission, not a discussion. It's a permission. So I, of course, I agree with you. Now, the reason that I stress so much issues around poverty is my personal bias because of my own work. And I would say that when it comes to middle-class women and upper-class women, actually, the problems they face are of a different nature, but they are there and very strongly, whether it is manifested in wage differentials, in being able to reconcile work with family obligations. Yes, I'm looking at Amar only because we have become friends through the years and I know how difficult it is, even in an environment as supportive as Bard College, right? To be able to have both in place. It is very hard. Political representation is an issue. So there are all these sort of indicators that people have come up with in terms of what it means for women to be empowered. And political participation, decision-making, etc., is part and parcel of it. If I can share a very personal sort of common feeling. I understand Amartya Sen's and Naila Kabir. I don't know how many of us are familiar with Naila Kabir. Amartya Sen is a household name, of course. Naila Kabir. Naila Kabir speaks about triangulation. You have to have resources. You have to have access and control over resources, and you have to have agency. The ability to determine and act on what you think you desire. For me, desire is a very, very strong word. To be able to dream, to be able to want and express that and go after it is only human. It is really about actualization of human potential, and it touches upon our humanity, and that's why feminism and humanism are very intermixed in my mind, actually. What makes Amartya Sen and Naila Kabir important in my personal life is that when it comes to the internalization of duty and obligation towards others, I think that I have to struggle with that on a daily basis. Because it is so embedded as to what I owe and what is owed to me that I have to circumvent it in familial relations. With friends, it is easier. In work environments, a little bit easier. But at that very personal level, it is something that we struggle with. So the internalization of values and the inability actually to act differently and to act as many women are acting, contesting, is deeply rooted. And I'm sure that the same applies for men. That in order to let go of the positions that they are taught they owe to occupy as providers, mythologies it may be, because women work and they work a lot, as we will see, but the carriers of that responsibility can be empowering and can be a huge burden at the same time. So I'm going beyond now economics, and I think I should stop soon because I'm being told that I have to stop. With one sentence, because we will come back to that, I'm sure, during Niloufer's presentation, feminism and the meaning that we ascribe. You see, to me, feminism starting point is a shared recognition that women in these structures of power have been disadvantaged across class, across countries, through the centuries. And whether I have patrilineal or matrilineal systems of inheritance, I find that there is such a consistent position that they occupy that it cannot be accidental. It cannot be due to culture. It is as powerful a category as class. It is not accidental. And it almost does not matter who occupies that position, but that position will be occupied. So there is a structure, and women have always been in that position. There is something to be done about it. And you know, it is in that sense that the last slide said it can be an emancipatory process. It can be a sense of belonging, a sense of universal family that one belongs to, when one's daily activity of teaching, of researching, of advocacy is so deeply rooted in both technical expertise and something one really believes in. Thank you very much for all your questions again.